This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
As a farmer, you certainly want to be very careful anytime you're dealing with any of the larger corporations, because they always have the advantage. And so much of this work in community-based food systems is finding where you have the advantage and using that, and trying to build that out.
There's little disagreement that urban farming translates into increased access to local, sustainable, and healthy food, and that this is a very good thing. But how is it done? What are the success stories of urban farming? And what exactly is a food shed? My guest this week on Sea Change Radio is Philip Ackerman Leist, an author, educator, and farmer. We learn about food sheds and discuss how urban farming has proliferated in cities like Cleveland, Detroit, and Oakland. He also tells us about how today's global menu and palate are creating a carbon-intensive food transport problem, and shares some of his best thinking on the ways to get a new generation of Americans engaged in helping ensure our food security future. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Philip Ackerman Leist. He's a professor at Green Mountain College in Sustainable Food Systems, and he's also the author of Rebuilding the Food Shed. Philip, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Great. Pleasure to be here with you, Alex. Thank you.
First, why don't you tell us what the food shed is? I've heard of watersheds, but not food sheds.
Right. Well, it's actually related to watersheds, and it's a pretty interesting history, I think. It goes back to 1929. The term was first coined by a fellow named Walter Hedden. He was the head of the Port Authority in New York City, and he was really interested in watersheds and what New York City was doing in protecting its own watershed and reaching out well beyond the limits of the city, obviously. So he was also beginning to think about food and the security of the food system in New York City. So he started to actually talk about and use the term food sheds. And so for him, a food shed really was what was coming in and out of the city, recognizing the flows, looking at how that was functioning. So he was interested, obviously, in protecting that. And then the term was picked up again in 1991 by a scholar named Arthur Goetz. He was writing in a permaculturalist magazine. And he also started putting this term forward for us to be thinking about our own food systems within our communities and what those might look like and how we might change them. And I'm really interested in the term. I think it's got potential to be explored, deeper and further as well. Well, I like to think of the food shed really as a means of new democracy, or really a way of trying to think about where the periphery of our influence is in terms of how we can make positive change for food systems. So how far can we reach out, not just within our communities, but a bit beyond? How far can we reach out and really create these more secure and sustainable and just food systems?
So much of the local food movement has been a little more focused on urban issues, and that's when you look at the real population density and where the inequality is in terms of healthy choices for food. It's really urban focused. But when I was looking on in chapter 6 of your book, I saw some very interesting maps that showed the demographics of diabetes, poverty, and obesity rates. And I did see some little outliers, and some of the highest rates of obesity and diabetes are in these very rural areas. How do we try to address these issues in rural areas where people are pretty much dependent on making a one-week trip to Walmart and loading up on as much food as they can just to try to make it affordable for them? How do we give them the kind of choices that somebody who goes to an urban farmer's market can get?
Mm-hmm.
And is it realistic too, I guess?
Yeah, I think it's certainly realistic. I mean, the beauty of these rural areas is the fact that, they very often have the land base where they could be producing more of their own food. The history of it all is such that we really relegated certain areas of the country to doing specialized agricultural production. And as a result, this specialization really gutted the diversification that we'd known for decades, if not centuries, in many of these places. places. And so as things became more specialized, these areas either, you know, started producing commodities of certain sorts, or in some cases, the agricultural production in those regions was just gutted. So it's really, it's incumbent upon us, I think, to find ways to restore not only the landscape, the agricultural landscape, but also restore the people's relationships, with the landscape and help them see ways in which it can actually be, you know, this landscape can be productive, ways in which they can actually tackle their food system, you know, there at home. It really involves a bit of a, reawakening in many ways. And bringing people back to their agricultural heritage. And the beauty of bringing people back to their agricultural heritage is that that's not a liberal agenda or a conservative agenda. It really moves all the way across the political spectrum. So, but then you've got the huge issue of really trying also to change consumer habits and also eating habits. And that's no insignificant task. It's not an easy thing to do by any means. But it's really exciting, as I work with young people and others to see this move afoot here. Some call it a movement. And, I think we're making some good headway, but we do have to recognize that it's very, very different in all of these regions, and the solutions are going to be different.
I guess what I'm wondering is, as the palate of the American consumer begins to expand, and we see more and more choices and all year-round choices, so you can get raspberries all year round now if you go to a Safeway in San Francisco, if they're flown in from Chile or Argentina or wherever. How can we rectify that as oil becomes more expensive and we realize that transportation is an important part of not just the expense, but the carbon footprint of the food that we eat? How can we continue to offer more and more food to people who live in the less densely populated areas at an affordable and an environmentally low impact manner?
So I think it's so much of this really is about, restoring not just the landscape, but really restoring the relationship between people and their landscape in these rural areas. And it also, brings in healthier food, because part of the issue here is we look at, health and also income, but is the fact that the less processed the food, the healthier it is, the fresher it is, obviously, the healthier it is. So really, rebuilding these foodscapes, if you will, these food sheds is a really important piece of trying to actually recreate a fabric, that combines community, landscape, and human health and well-being. And, and it's not that those are in innovative ways, but there are ways certainly that we've lost over the past couple of generations.
Americans spend almost half of their household food budgets eating away from home. You would think that in a more remote area that this would not be the case. Is that the case, or are they just making poor decisions when they're shopping and cooking for themselves?
Yeah, when you look at the kinds of calories that are consumed in this away from home food, as the USDA is calling it, those calories are, they're higher in number, they're poorer in nutritional value, and they very often create the kinds of issues that we're really worried about, particularly with regard to obesity and diabetes. So those away from home foods that we consume, are really problematic in and of themselves. But the irony is, some of that is happening at restaurants and fast food joints, but a lot of it is happening in schools and senior centers, colleges and universities, hospitals, and I'm not convinced those things are going to go away. And, even people like myself are, walking over to the college dining hall. And it's just really incumbent upon these institutions to try to find healthier ways to produce food. And if nowhere else, for Pete's sake, that needs to happen in the hospitals, at the very least. And there's some great examples around the country of hospitals that have really picked up on this and really started to see food, as a means of healing their patients, and in many cases as the primary form. So trying to get these institutions on board is a big piece of it. And obviously, changing people's consumer habits in terms of fast food is an important piece. That one's not necessarily as easy.
Straight to weeds. To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Philip Ackerman Leist. His new book is Rebuilding the Food Shed, How to Create Local, Sustainable, and Secure Food Systems. In your book, you note how the farmers are an aging population in this country. What kind of solutions have you come up with to try to rectify the system and to try to get more young people involved in agriculture?
Yeah, fortunately, I think that the ennui that some of our young people are facing as they grow up in various regions of the country, very often the suburbs and the urban areas, they're really yearning for the opportunity to engage with the land and also engage with their communities. And so, you know, what I've seen over the past 17 to 20 years of doing this really is that there's an incredible interest among young people in getting involved in farming. And, you know, it's not that the struggle right now is finding ways to really help them build out their visions. You know, as they try to go into farming, you know, they realize very quickly it's an intellectual enterprise as well as a physical enterprise. You know, it's very entrepreneurial in nature. It's also very capital intensive in many ways. And so as they're trying to build a land base, get infrastructure, really build out the markets, you know, anything we can do to help them in that regard, you know, really ensures the future security of our local food systems.
And you talk about the future security, and we often hear about our energy security and that energy is really a security issue, but food security is something that you examine quite a bit as well. First, define food security, and moving forward, how do we engage our political class to take this on as just as important an issue as quote-unquote defense?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, the food security aspect is something that's very important, and the USDA and others have been, you know, working on it and defining this term. But essentially, you know, in its essence, food security is about the ability of an individual or a household to procure not only, you know, the right nutritional content, but also food that's culturally appropriate for them. So being able to procure that food and make sure that there's enough within the household so that there's not malnutrition. And that malnutrition can come in two forms. You know, the old way of thinking about malnutrition was actually not having enough calories. You know, as we look at malnutrition now, we're seeing obviously that actually involves, you know, having too many calories very often, or the wrong kinds of calories.
In terms of making policy, we see Monsanto and its ilk have just seemingly endless dollars to spend to try to lobby politicians to get their way. How do we engage the Monsantos and Cargills to use those dollars and hopefully show them that there can be profit in healthy foods?
Well, I think one of the really important pieces in all of this, and it's easy to get frustrated with the situation that we have in front of us, which is really, you know, feels very much like a David and Goliath scenario. You know, my view on it is that we really have to build as much market distinction, i.e. distance, you know, from these particular, you know, corporations, build as much distance as we can. If you think of it in terms of a lever, you know, and you want to move something that's, you know, much bigger than you are, you've got to get a lever, you know, as long as you can possibly get it, and you got to place the fulcrum in just the right place, and you've got to move it from a distance. And I think that's one of the things that we need to think more about. You know, the impact that we're going to have in actually moving these corporations is primarily by, you know, distancing ourselves in terms of, you know, the values that we have as opposed to the values that are there, or in some cases, some of us would argue the lack of values that are held on behalf of, you know, some of these corporations. So that market distinction is really important, and it is based on values. And I think that's one of the greatest hopes. And, you know, the fact is the numbers are really going up in terms of local food sales, both direct, you know, that is farm-to-consumer sales, as well as the intermediated sales, that is where there's a middle person involved. And so those numbers are going up, and at the same time, these corporations are beginning to pay attention. What we've got to do is really be vigilant to make sure that we keep the distinction between what we're doing and what many of them are doing.
First of all, these companies aren't just going to go away. They're yep. They're huge, and you did mention the David and Goliath aspect of it. Secondly, they're so insidiously ingrained into our food shed and into our food system that most consumers don't even know when they're eating these products. Is there a way to get Monsanto and Cargill and these other big corporations to start to value local farmers? And is there a way for them to see that there could be profit in catering to local farmers instead of just big industrial agriculture, and that there could be not only benefit to them, but having a societal benefit?
That's a really interesting point. I guess, you know, that really brings me, Alex, back to my notion of what a food shed is. And that's, you know, again, the ability really, you know, to create positive change. And, you know, and also an important part of that is actually that you have increased transparency, you know, within the a food shed like that. So I don't want to say that it's unimportant to try and actually, you know, find some points of intersection between, you know, local and small, even medium-sized farmers in these corporations, or that we shouldn't be paying attention to the federal level. But, you know, as far as where we put our energies first, I think it really is in trying to build out these community-based food systems, that's really where we know we can make a difference. When we start reaching out and it starts, you know, we start meddling, if you will, in some of these marketplaces, there's no reason not to tinker with that and see what can happen. But, you know, as a farmer, you certainly want to be very careful anytime you're dealing with any of the larger corporations, because they always have the advantage. And so much of this work in community-based food systems is finding where you have the advantage and using that, you know, and trying to build that out. So I am, you know, I think it's going to be tough to actually get corporations like Monsanto, Syngenta, and others really to help out small-scale farmers, to help community-based food systems. That's not really the business model. And frankly, if they come into some of these conversations, and I think we do need to have the conversations with them, but if they come in with leverage and marketing power, you know, we can very easily, I think, lose the more democratic kind of process that we're trying to create with community-based food systems.
Maybe that's why they're so anathema to embrace GMO labeling, because they like to be insidiously injected into our food system. They don't want consumers to necessarily know and be conscious of what they're eating, because that would kind of belie their very model.
Yeah, I think where we've been really effective in the world of sustainable agriculture and sustainable food systems is building out these points of market distinction. And those points, again, are based on values, and very important values that many of us hold dear. And, you know, so I think we've got to keep that. You know, you look at how organic, you know, has grown over the years, and that's because of market distinction. You look at local, that's market distinction. You know, and then as we do more and more that's focused on community, that also starts to create relationships, and that's where these corporations, you know, they can't get their foot in the door. They can't create the kind of relationship that the farmer-consumer approach can have.
They were hiding behind hay bales. They were planting in the full moon. They had given all they had for something new. But the light of day was on them. They could see the thrashers coming, and the water shone like diamonds in the dew. And I was just getting up, hit the road before it's light, trying to catch an hour on the sun. When I saw those thrashers rolling by, looking more than two lanes wide, I was feeling like my day had just begun.
If you ever find yourself wanting to know more about the music we play here on Sea Change Radio, go to seachangeradio.com and click on the Music tab at the top of the page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Philip Ackerman Leist. His new book is Rebuilding the Food Shed: How to Create Local, Sustainable, and Secure Food Systems. Philip, this is another chart, which is always not a great thing to translate into radio, but it's an analysis of Detroit's estimated local production capacity on vacant lots. And it's a pretty interesting way to view arable land, so to speak. We don't think of Detroit as a potential place for farming, but why don't you explain, if you can, without visuals, what this means for somebody who lives in an urban area like Detroit and the potential of the land that they live on?
Yeah, and I think these examples pop up in different parts of the country, places like Detroit and Cleveland and Oakland, you know, some of the examples that are pretty well researched here. But as we look at these vacant lots that are popping up and nowhere more than Detroit, it's really a fascinating exercise to try to think about what a city might look like with agriculture really well embedded, you know, within its own environs. And that's where Detroit, I think, is really a model. I mean, you know, granted, we don't know where this thing is going to go exactly, but there is this kind of Phoenix Rising approach that seems to be happening in Detroit. And so really trying to find ways to embed agricultural production within the city, link it to economic development, link it to nutrition and health, link it actually to building community centers, and having these green oases that pop up throughout the city. So I'm really fascinated to see where all this goes, and I think that's where the real promise is, more probably in my view than, you know, vertical farming, which is something that is fascinating and interesting. But these are community-based systems, and they're really trying to bring a city back, you know, from the brink. So one of the interesting things as you look at this is just, you know, what kind of percentages can be produced in terms particularly of fruits and vegetables of the city's need in these particular cases. You know, and the Detroit numbers, as folks have run them, you know, can look fairly high. Oakland, a friend of mine, Nathan McClintock, actually has done the numbers there, and he thinks maybe that Oakland could get to 5% of its fruit and vegetable production, maybe 10 if the farmers were real professionals. And that's one of the key points here. Who's going to do this farming? Because farming is a very specialized skill set. And if we're really going to build out the production within the cities, we need to have people who are very savvy farmers, you know, who are doing that. If it's too amateurish, that's all well and good, and you want that, but it's only going to take us so far.
That's an important distinction. Why don't you give us an example of the difference between setting up a farm where you live in Vermont as opposed to one in Oakland?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to think much differently. I mean, first of all, you're going to need to think about where this all starts. And one of the issues in many of the cityscapes, if you will, is that you often have to remediate the soils. You really got to start there, make sure that there aren't things like heavy metal loads that are too high there. So you need to have the soils tested. You very often need to amend those soils, you know, and so that's where it's really important to have municipal waste systems, you know, that actually capture organic matter and recycle it. So, you know, that's the first thing you got to do is make sure you've got the fertility to build this whole thing out, you know, and then you start thinking about the customer base and what that looks like. And one of the neat things about doing this in the cityscape is the fact that very often there are certain cultures that you might actually cater to in terms of your audience, that is certain ethnic communities. And that's, again, that's a way of having market distinction and actually creating a market base that hopefully is going to support you in that process.
So you're thinking, like, for example, Houston has a pretty large Vietnamese population, maybe growing more cilantro or bean sprouts in that area to cater to that ethnic population. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great example. You know, and the Hmong farmers are some of the best, you know, anywhere in the world, and you'll see them in various cities, and you know, they're very effective. Sudanese populations that have settled. It's really interesting to look at that because it's an automatic market in many cases, and people are really yearning for the foods that they find to be culturally appropriate. And it also goes in Detroit. It was really interesting talking to people at D-Town Farm there because they're, you know, so many of the African Americans migrated to Detroit, you know, and found themselves in Detroit and not necessarily with the food sources that that they really held near and dear.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the author of Rebuilding the Food Shed, Philip Ackerman Leist. Philip, in your book, you focus mostly on agriculture, but can we talk about meat for a second?
Mm-hmm.
This is obviously an important part of the American diet. How do we begin to make it cost effective for urban farmers to incorporate meat into their diet?
Yeah, it's something I'm interested in, actually having cattle at home that we sell for beef, and I'm interested in looking at how anything in the rural environment might translate into the urban environment or not.
Well, let's focus then just on beef. We did a piece not so long ago on Estancia Beef, which is an importer from Argentina, and the CEO, Bill Reed, was saying, having grass-fed beef in Argentina is so much more cost-effective, and it's such an easier thing to do, and they don't have to compete with industrial food lots, and it actually the cost of shipping it from Argentina is a wash. It's they could still come in at a very competitive price point. And on one hand, that's very encouraging, especially for his business, but it's also discouraging in that, like, industrial food lots have become such an important part of our beef supply that it's next to impossible for domestically produced beef to be cost competitive. How do we somehow begin to rectify that imbalance?
You know, it's a tough imbalance. I think in some cases, you know, one wants to make the argument that we do need to pay a bit more for our food, our meat in particular.
But then when you look at the poverty issues and things, that if you're some single mom on welfare with three kids, you're going to go for the cheapest ground beef you can.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the rub here. And so, you know, one of the most challenging things, I think, in rebuilding these community-based food systems is finding the price points that are going to work, you know, for the consumer, particularly those who most need it, and that are also going to work for the farmer. Again, I think trying to get back a little bit closer to the point where we're using meat a bit more as a spice and not always these big whole cuts that we're so accustomed to. But you can actually, in doing grass-fed beef, which is what we do at home, there are ways to actually bring the cost down, particularly in times of, you know, when there's spikes in oil prices and spikes in grain prices. Those of us who are doing grass-based beef have a real advantage there. We can also do a lot more in terms of stretching out the season, you know, in which we're grazing. You know, we can really go well into the winter season and still have animals grazing if we're really careful about how we manage the landscape. And one of the interesting things, too, that's not talked about enough in the, you know, in any of the meat circles, as far as I'm concerned, is we always have in the situation in the fall at slaughterhouses where they're completely backed up and everybody can't get their animals in there. The beauty of doing grass-based beef and some other products as well is that they're really at their prime. In our case here in Vermont, they're really at their prime the end of June, early July, and that's a low capacity time for slaughterhouses. So if we can start making that work so the grass-based producers, you know, are using some of these alternate periods, then, you know, I think we've got a win-win for folks. I just don't know how we're going to solve the price point issue in terms of meat. It really is one of the most complex issues here.
Yes, I mean, on one hand, it's great that there are cheap alternatives for people who would otherwise maybe go hungry. But in the long-term effects, both as a society and just for those families, it's a mixed blessing to be able to find such discounted chicken and beef and some of these other industrially farmed products.
Farmers are taking note. They're not inattentive to the issues that are out there and feeding their communities. And I've got several friends, you know, who are farmers here in this area, and that's one of the things they're really paying attention to. So they'll offer special prices, you know, for folks who are coming in that they know have real challenges, or in some cases they'll also the SNAP benefits that are offered at the farmers market using the EBT machines, the electronic bank transfer machines, that the SNAP benefits being, you know, what we used to call food stamps. Sometimes at some farmers markets, farmers will actually offer a twofer, you know, so that if you come in, you know, and you have SNAP benefits, they'll actually provide twice the product for you. And I think that's really admirable. And that's one of the ways that we start to solve this, and we start to solve it from the basis of relationships and really appreciation for everyone that one finds in one's community.
His new book is Rebuilding the Food Shed, Philip Ackerman Leist. Philip, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Entirely my pleasure, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Terrence Blanchard, The Who, and Neil Young. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.